Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
Welcome to the Dr. Kim Sage Show. I'm your host, Kim Sage. I'm a clinical psychologist in Newport Beach, but I'm a local in Laguna Beach. And this show airs live every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on KX93.5. Tonight, we are going to be talking about addiction and trauma and really what the relationships are between trauma and how we might find ourselves or someone we love facing addiction and sort of what are the roots of that? How might they connect to trauma? My guest tonight is Bert Shepley. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in Newport Beach in addiction, trauma, and EMDR. Welcome, Bert.
Thank you, Dr. Kim. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me. Bert has a lot of experience in addiction and trauma and EMDR, so he was the perfect choice for this show. You also have an office in private practice in Newport Beach, but you also do work at a treatment center.
Right. So I work in a treatment center 40 hours a week about, and then I see private clients in the evenings.
Oh, so you have a lot of free time.
Yeah.
Do you have a work addiction maybe? I don't know.
No.
Just kidding. That's great, actually. Okay. And so let's just, before we get into what Bert does, we're just going to give you a little background on what is trauma, and then we'll talk about addiction. So the APA, our typical association for psychology, the American Association, says that trauma is an emotional response to a terrible event like an accident, rape, or natural disaster. Immediately after the event, shock and denial are typical. Longer-term reactions include unpredictable emotions, flashbacks, strained relationships, and even physical symptoms like headaches or nausea. While these feelings are normal, some people have difficulty moving on with their lives. Now, that's sort of the classic trauma definition, but you and I know that trauma is a lot more than just, you know, witnessing a natural disaster or being part of a violent experience. So we really think of it as a disturbing event that sort of infringes upon our sense of control, and it may reduce our capacity to sort of integrate that situation into reality. So it's like bigger than our brains can handle, right? We can't even deal with it and process it in the moment. But trauma can also be an accumulation of small events, like having an extremely critical parent or a mentally ill parent or being bullied, right? I mean, divorce. There's a whole bunch of things that can begin to accumulate and create trauma for us. So part of my mission at this point is to sort of educate people about trauma. Would you agree that people don't tend to understand what we're talking about typically when we say trauma in the way that you and I think about it?
Absolutely. Most people think of it in terms of just the one single big event. But really, it's any events that overwhelm our ability to cope, which often happens when we're children because we don't have any ability to sort of regulate our emotions at that point or anything. So it's easy to get overwhelmed and have these things sort of carry on with us throughout our lives. But many people don't associate what happened back then with what's going on now. They figure, oh, that happened a long time ago. It has nothing to do with me now.
Right. Yeah, I'll be sitting in the room with people and I'll be saying, you know, so tell me about your childhood or the classic conversation. Did you have this or that? And they'll like, oh yeah, you know, I forgot that my stepdad died when I was 4 and my mom remarried 3 times. But you know, it was a fine childhood. Just like, okay, hold on a minute. Now, I guess for some people that may not be traumatic, maybe they found a way to integrate it. But I would say if you have a bunch of events like that, you're more likely impacted. And so would you say that part of your job is educating people too about what trauma is?
Educating people about what trauma is, as well as educating them about what addiction is. So yes, both.
Okay. So let's talk about addiction. How do we define addiction? What's the difference between just use and addiction?
Well, I guess one thing, addiction is the popular term for using now, like in our DSM-5, which is our handbook for therapy. It's really divided into substance use disorder. So it's not either you're addicted or you're not addicted, but there's a whole level, different levels and different criteria you can meet to have a mild substance use disorder, moderate or severe. But basically it's the use of a substance or a behavior which is compulsive and which people continue despite negative consequences, really.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a good point, because we do differentiate between different levels of severity of use, whether it's dependence, do you have to have it, how do you use it? And a lot of people, I think, well, I only get super hammered, you know, a couple times a year. Now it causes a whole lot of chaos for my family. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, every now and then I overdo it. I think around here, let's just talk about alcohol in general. The drinking culture is so normalized. Mm-hmm. So many parents in my practice, I'm seeing teens, they're partying. It's like, oh, we're doing this, we're doing that with alcohol. And I just think that people don't understand. Well, we're saying addiction, right? It's not clinical. But there really is a set of problems that can be associated with that kind of use.
Right. So once you take away that term addiction, number one, you can take away a lot of shame and everything that goes with that and just understand it to be a problem to which you can find a resolution, hopefully, no matter what the severity level is. But shame gets involved for a number of reasons. Shame gets involved in trauma because oftentimes a person can feel like they should have done something or could have done something or had survivor guilt or whatever it might be, and shame will cause them to shut down and not express themselves emotionally about what might be bothering them. And then as well in addiction, a lot of shame goes with it just by the damage that's been caused by the addiction, even if the person's not their intent, but that's what's happened. Right. So there's a lot of shame, or even consider it toxic shame.
Yeah, and I think that I want to really talk about shame and the role it plays. And let's just give our audience a little bit of history on the ACEs study. So I just have a little information. So this was called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And it was done back in the late 90s. Researchers collected data from about 17,000, actually it was like 17,500 Kaiser Permanente HMO patients. Mm-hmm. And they were able to link childhood experiences of trauma and instability to adult health problems, such as cancer, heart disease, all kinds of issues, including mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And so what we're talking about is really these were the extreme. And let me just say, this population was a middle-income Caucasian population primarily. Mm-hmm. So if you think about, socioeconomic status and the risk for trauma, we want to think that likely it's even higher in other populations, right? Mm-hmm. But we're talking about things like child abuse, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, household challenges like family violence, substance use, mental illness, divorce, incarceration of a family member, neglect. And so there are these questions, right? And so every time you had to say yes, then that basically gives you a point. And so as you get to a certain number, as you increase, so increases the amount of potential lifetime difficulties with mental and physical health.
Right.
Right. Okay.
So we can't prove, this equals this or this causes this. We just really look at the number of risk factors involved and see what has to be kind of worked on to help the person not relapse if it's addiction or work through depression or whatever it might be that's associated with these childhood events.
So what we're saying is when you have a higher ACEs number, you have a higher chance of addiction, of having substance use issues, right? So when a person comes in to see you, I give the ACEs to my clients. Do you do that as well?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So how do you start to help them unwrap? Because as we were saying at the beginning of the show, not everything is this extreme of trauma, but it is still trauma. Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of break down what is, the classic trauma, what are the other things? How do you do that? What's your process?
Very gently, in a way, because somebody might not consider it to be traumatic. Some of it might be, again, so shameful that they don't want to talk about it. It's just sort of asking them, as they go over what events have kind of occurred in their life, if any of them really bring up some distress, you can kind of start asking about that. One of the primary issues that involved with ACEs really is attachment issues, because all of these problems cause attachment issues between child and parent generally. And a lot of people consider addiction to be an attachment disorder.
So let's talk about that. So as we go on, I am talking with Bert Shepley for just tuning in. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in addiction and trauma and EMDR. And we're talking about the relationship between addiction and trauma. And so what were you just going to share with us about these issues with the ACEs study?
That as children are growing up, they, or we, all do better, in essence, if we have sort of a stable family kind of situation, if we have attachment, secure attachment with our caregivers, at least one caregiver in our lives, and that means that we're the child is attuned to by the parent, the child's needs are met, child's cared for. If the child does not, and a child is completely dependent on a parent, so the child, if it's not getting those needs met for whatever reasons, the parent could be depressed, the parents could be have an addiction issue, whatever the case may be, the child will then develop sort of an insecure attachment, not sure who to trust with caring for them or how to care for themselves, which leaves them vulnerable to self-soothing kinds of activities, which could easily lead to certainly risky behaviors or, you know, substance use disorders.
Okay. So, you know, you're having these experiences in childhood, you're doing the best you can. I know kids are egocentric, so everything is about them in some way. It's about, you know, they don't think this, I always tell my clients, but it's about you, you know, by osmosis, you don't, aren't, I'm not worthy of your love or whatever, you can't meet my needs. And I love adult attachment. I just think it's fascinating. And I think most people like think it's interesting too, in terms of the quality of caregiving, because we're not just talking about extreme cases of abuse or neglect. Like you said, a parent can have mental illness and be depressed, but they're not really there with you.
Right.
And so you're like, what's going on? You know, something is not tangible about this experience. And you're right. So then you're opening to find other ways to be soothed, to be comforted, whether it's through isolating or becoming avoidant, not trusting people, or seeking it in everyone you can find, you know? And so I think that because of the sort of dopamine that we can experience, let's say with opiates, things like that, that is hitting a need for people that they may really, you know, are trying to fill.
Right. And it's hitting the need. And that's what allows parents and children to bond, is our natural opioid system, if you will, allows us to feel good, the endorphins. And if people are growing up with a lack of dopamine receptors based on early trauma, that can leave them vulnerable to wanting to fill that dopamine with certain drugs of abuse.
Right. And also, we know there's a genetic component, right? So we're looking at all these different factors between what's the resilience, and I would say what's the constitution of someone, right? We just don't really know.
No.
What you had, I could have the same thing, but now I have an addiction and you don't, or a problem with substances.
Yeah, it's all an individual journey in and an individual journey out. I mean, there's broad brushstrokes that are the same about addictions and trauma, if you will, but it's an individual story every time. It's unique.
That's really important to say, So what do you see, let's just talk about sort of a typical day for you working at the treatment center. So let's walk through what you see, what you do, and what that's like.
Okay, so in the treatment center, we're obviously at the point where someone's entered a treatment for a substance use. It's actually a dual diagnosis treatment center, so we're also dealing with mental health issues that go along with the substance use issue. First thing you want to try to determine is what is the stage of change that the client is in. In other words, are they pre-contemplation? They don't think they have a problem. They're contemplation. Maybe I have a problem. Maybe I do. Maybe I don't. Now, you'd think someone going to treatment would be, oh, yeah, I definitely have a problem, but it's not really it. Maybe there's some issues, but they're not really sure they want to give anything up or do anything. And all the way up to, you know, action and maintenance stages of change and relapsing stages of change. So where they are in those stages of change kind of determines how you might approach that person. But in the treatment, we do individual therapy, we do group therapy, we do lots of different kinds of activities. Today I did a poetry therapy group.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Just allowing people to learn to express their emotions in safe ways, in different ways, whether it's through art or music, writing, as well as just kind of standard talk kinds of therapies.
There's a lot of good stuff in that.
Yeah.
So let's go back for a second to pre-contemplation. Mm-hmm. Some people may not know what that really means. So what does that look like in a person that's coming in? And let's just walk through those stages.
Well, even coming in, or even maybe before they come in, they don't want to come in, or any of the listeners may recognize this, where the person is saying either, there's a problem, but I don't want to do anything about it. So that's, you're not contemplating any change. Or I don't see a problem, you're the problem. Or whatever it is, they're not recognizing that there is an issue that they want to change.
So what do you do with that? If someone comes in, like they got drug in there or whatever, they've got court ordered, I don't know how that works, right? So they're there, but they don't really believe that it's really an issue. How do you deal with that?
So the initial approach that's used by most people or parents or whatever is, see, you have this problem, is kind of bang it into the person. And the person generally just defends their behavior. This is a normal human response to push back. Don't tell me what I'm doing wrong. You know, don't show me. Mm-hmm. So it's really just through a discussion. It's trying to find out what the person likes about whatever it is the behavior is, what they get out of it, where there might be some problems. You know, maybe someone's told them something, maybe something somewhere. And just getting them to use in their own words, there might be an issue somewhere, and then your foot's kind of in the door, and you try to go in through that. So it's not through any sort of accusatory terms, which is like, you're messing up here, which is what you want to do.
Right.
But you have to come at it a little more sideways and gently to get them to say it in their own words.
Because, yeah, you're back to shame, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
Right.
You need a little crack in the door, a little light to get in, right?
Right.
So you can get in there.
And some acceptance that the person is, you know, human or making mistakes. And again, to your point, the shame can stop them dead in their tracks because they don't want to admit that there's a problem that they're causing people. So I think we were talking about it before. Someone with an addiction is kind of like a boat going through a marina. You know, you're supposed to go through nice and slowly and leave a no wake zone, but some boats just plow through and they leave a giant wake and they just wreck all kinds of boats and leave all sorts of destruction around them. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like what a person with an addiction can do with a family or work or anything.
And which also creates more trauma,
creates more trauma. Right. And it's an ongoing loop. So working with trauma with someone with an addiction could be trauma that initially created a vulnerability to their use. It could also be trauma resulting from their use.
Right. So can you give us some examples of what we're talking about when we're talking about trauma being another byproduct of your addiction and sort of what happens for people? Do you have some stories?
Well, I mean, the stories can be pretty just, I mean, basically horrific. I mean, you have people using when they have babies. They have people, you know, just letting, when you're focused on one thing that's really not serving any beneficial purpose, so like a substance, then everything else is just going to fall by the wayside. And it makes no sense from the outside because it's like you have a kid. Like, what are you doing? But that's the nature of, if you will, addiction, that part of the person is just not quite in sync to get them to stop, even though they recognize it's kind of a problem. So without going to the stories, you can just imagine people losing jobs, losing families, in our world of opioid addictions and opioid stuff, you've got tons of people who are dying of overdoses and getting Narcan back. They're overdosing, but getting Narcan back to life. Mm. And they know tons of other people who have died of overdoses. It's like talking to people coming out of the Iraq War or something. I mean, the amount of death and destruction that a number of our youth, anywhere from 18 to 26, 28, are seeing or hearing about on a regular basis, as well as they themselves may be so far along, they're like, whatever.
Right.
So it's very sad and it's very difficult. And it's very, very difficult for parents to try to deal with this if that's their child, or for that matter, for the child if that's their parent, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I want to talk about the impact on the family members in a minute, too.
Okay.
Let's talk about, as you were speaking a few minutes ago, you were talking about the inability to have emotional expression.
Mm-hmm.
What role do you think that plays for people in terms of substance use, that they're unable to connect to a sense of self, to feelings, things like that? Or maybe they're overly connected to their feelings, I think was the other thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. So somebody could be coming into, you know, out of childhood trauma or out of whatever kinds of childhood issues or young adult issues, and they're either in such kind of trauma that they're numb, they've learned to numb their emotions, so the drug is the only way to feel something, or conversely, they're so overwhelmed with emotion, they're so sensitized to trauma that they need to deaden things down. So it seems sort of paradoxical, but it's kind of both. It's like somebody self-harming.
Right.
It doesn't make sense. It only makes sense to that person in that moment.
Right.
Yeah. So another big topic with this is isolation. We're talking about, that's why it's kind of also considered an attachment disorder. Mm-hmm. Addicts generally are doing this in isolation. This is not about social drinking or social use. It's really about isolation. People sitting alone in motel rooms, hotel rooms, their own apartments, their houses. It's a world filled with secrets. They're not telling other people what's going on. They're hiding things mm-hmm. around the house as much as they can.
Right.
To that point about shame.
So is that really one of the markers if a person is using alone to an extreme degree?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about people who can just start finishing off fifths of vodka, handles of vodka, that kind of thing, as well as heroin, meth,
right?
You know, those stronger kinds of drugs.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the clients I have where it's the spouse or the partner who starts to find these items of paraphernalia, whether it's drug use or alcohol, little mini bottles from the mini bar or whatever. And it's really devastating for family too. But before we talk about that as well, how much does a person's family or friends being upset with them or devastated by them affect their decision to stop using, do you think?
Again, it just depends on, sometimes it takes an intervention to get the person to admit. Again, it's that pre-contemplation or that shame. Say change, they don't admit there's a problem. Sometimes family members can get them to admit there's a problem. Family members are often encouraged to go to Al-Anon for family members of addicts so they can understand basically what is going on with them and, you know, learning about what enabling is of children or loved ones who are going through these. I don't know if you saw the movie or read the book Beautiful Boy, but that's a great example of that.
Right.
Where the father just finally had to say, like, enough. I can't do this anymore as much as it kills me.
Right.
Yeah.
And it really does kill families.
It kills families.
It really does. It's so much. Speaking of trauma, so you have the person who is in the addiction or in their difficulty, and then you have the trauma of the family members.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that.
Which part? The trauma of the family members?
Yeah, by the family.
Yeah, so you can imagine that the children, again, the children, you know, there's a group of adult children, you know, of alcoholics. When you're growing up in that environment, it's not a stable environment. It's almost kind of like growing up with a constant earthquake going on. You're never sure what to expect from your parents when you get home. Is someone going to be mad? Is someone going to be reeling around? Is somebody going to be violent? Is someone going to be asleep on the couch? Who knows what it's going to be? So there's often that disconnect. It can bring up a lot of abuse and violence in a household and in a relationship. And then again, the most important thing is the person only cares about that substance, really. It's like the salience of, you know, it's what's important. That substance is what is the most important thing, and all else revolves around it. So the person becomes very, if you will, narcissistic in the sense that you're here for me, you know, and you're here, all this world is around me to give me my drug, right. And I will start, you know, organizing my world around that drug.
Right.
Which you can see with kids as early as 14, organizing the world around marijuana, maybe, you know, all the way up through adults.
Yeah, let's talk about marijuana too. But in terms of family and how they deal with it, you know, this is why we are talking about trauma, because I think that kids don't realize, you know, that having a parent who has an addiction problem is traumatic. And I have people in my practice that will say, well, my mom drank too much. But, you know, until we go in and talk about how has that affected how you see yourself, how you are in relationships, how much you trust the world around you.
Right.
You know, I think that we would normalize it so much, unless it's like so crazy extreme.
Right.
But I think so often that's why you and I are talking about
trauma. We learn to adapt.
Yeah, we have to survive it.
Right.
So we have to like alter the rules of the universe to survive this environment. But they don't always translate so well later.
Right. And so, what, you know, in therapy, one of the things we do is working with a client who is coming through an addiction and is now facing all the damage that this person has done, whether male or female, and sort of reframing the situation in a way that not so much that I'm a terrible person at my core, but I am a terrible person maybe in my addiction, but I am just a person,
right?
You know, at my core, capable of doing harmful things in my addiction. So separating the two so the person can work on the addiction and still then try to work on healing with everyone else as their sober selves.
Right. So what therapies do you use in that? So if you're getting somebody who's processing through and they've had a lot of trauma, when can you bring in, and let's talk about EMDR, I'll let you talk about EMDR a little bit. When can you bring that in? So first discuss what EMDR is, please.
Well, let me jump back from that a little bit just to say that the idea of these other kinds of, they're sort of like imagery-based therapies, is because a lot of these sort of traumas, particularly when people are young, are not very accessible to verbal, left brain kinds of interventions. So just talking to a person about a trauma can actually get that person to relive that trauma and put them into like a worse situation.
Right.
So we try to use other kinds of therapy, such as EMDR or hypnosis, or there's a whole bunch, EFT, there's a whole bunch of imagery-based therapies, if you will, mm-hmm. that allow people to express more from their right brain and body, if you will, express what's going on with that trauma and allow them to work through it and metabolize those trauma memories in an adaptive way. I know it's kind of confusing, but...
It is, but it isn't. I think once you get into it more, it makes sense. But I think that what you're talking about is really important for people, that I think a lot of therapists, if you're not a trauma-informed therapist, you may not mm-hmm. understand that you may be reactivating your client's trauma.
Right.
Really important. Mm-hmm. You think you're talking about it and working it through, but they're actually having dreams and nightmares and acting out or whatever, right? So mm-hmm. We are thinking about other therapies now. We understand more mm-hmm. about trauma.
So I've used, for example, EMDR with clients with issues ranging all the way from the shootings in Las Vegas to military clients to childhood abuse victims, either there's adults or, you know, as the teens, whatever those kind of traumas are. And these are severe traumas that leave a lot of PTSD kind of symptoms where the memories are not integrated in sort of a narrative whole way. They're just stored as fragments. And these fragments of memories of sensations, sounds, pictures, whatever they are, have a life of their own and they're a timeless sort of way. They're not distant memory and they come up and they're just as real now in the memory mm-hmm. as when the event happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you're just tuning in, we are talking with Bert Shepley. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in addiction and trauma and EMDR. And EMDR is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. It's such a lot of words. But EMDR is really trending, as they say, in terms mm-hmm. of therapy. And I do it, and you are mm-hmm. a consultant, right? Mm-hmm. So you've been certified in. It's just incredible watching people go into the memory and be able to process it. I've done it myself, mm-hmm. so I can also speak yeah. to it. Yes, you've done it as
yes.
well. It's so crazy how you can have this experience with it and then no longer you have that energy with it.
Mm-hmm.
You can think about it, but it's not like, you know, I know this word is, I love this word triggering. Everyone hates this word now, mm-hmm. but it's not so activating. You sort mm-hmm. of like, oh, okay, that happened, but I'm not in it anymore.
Well, a distant memory, if you kind of focus on a distant memory, even something that kind of bothered you at one time or bothered you a lot, it just becomes further away. It's maybe like black and white. It's sort of dull, fuzzy.
Right, right.
It's not alive and vibrant, you know, in sounds and pictures. So EMDR is a holistic type of therapy that uses both emotions and body and cognitions all together to work with the trauma. Because as we know, trauma is not just simply some kind of brain thing. It's a whole body. We hold trauma everywhere in our body.
Right.
And people can be very unaware of even the trauma that's there, but then feel like, you know, I have a lot of tightness in my throat.
Right.
And that's representing maybe something that they're trying to yell or talk or whatever when they're doing something or they want to speak. And so we just work through the body.
Right.
And trauma can release actually with just focusing on the body sensations, which is similar also to somatic experiencing. And like I said, there's a number of therapies now
right.
that aren't just simply cognitive, verbal type yeah. of therapies.
I love that book, Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score.
Yes.
Yes. But it really is this idea that we can have trauma
mm-hmm.
and it can be in our body. It can come mm-hmm. out in chronic fatigue and mm-hmm. autoimmune diseases, right.
right?
I mean, we are learning so much about that. I'd rather my body be sick than me have to deal with my feelings about mm-hmm. something.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that just, I think is so fascinating.
Right. Or people can also completely shut off their feelings. Completely shut off their feelings. And then it's really just a defense mechanism, which has allowed them to survive that trauma by not allowing themselves to feel. We talked about that before, that sort of numbing. But when they get into EMDR or something, it's just, there's nothing.
Right.
So to speak.
Right.
Because they've completely blocked it off.
Right.
As a way to cope with it.
Yeah, I've had some people who have a hard time. I'm like, okay, well, where do you feel that in your body? And they're like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, okay, let's start to talk about what that feels like when mm-hmm. your chest tightens or when you feel like you can't breathe or your, you know, legs or your toes are numb or something.
Yeah, so people can develop what's kind of called alexithymia. Mm-hmm. It's not an actual sort of clinical disorder. It's just a description of an inability to understand, read emotions. And so that can come from very traumatic childhood where, again, you've learned that emotions are not helpful.
Right.
Because you're not going to spend all your time crying and you can't be angry at whatever the situation is. So you just go
right
numb, stoic. Right. Yeah, I guess in a way, in early adolescence, it's considered, if you will, controversially maybe, but sort of normal to experiment with things. It's if people are vulnerable to wanting more stimulation or to feel something, then they're the ones who might really go experiment and use things a lot. So someone coming into adolescence who's learned to block all their feelings has to learn how to communicate with people just to sort of get along. Drugs are an easy currency, number one, to get to know other kids. And number two, it allows you to get the rush from certain drugs and certain fun, you know, certain drugs, and allows you to get those feelings that you don't know how to get through regular parts of life. So you manufacture them with drugs, right, which are basically shortcuts to these kinds of feelings.
Mm-hmm. So when they're using, they're getting to actually, well, they're actually numbing out more, mm-hmm, but they're also connecting to some vibrancy, I suppose, and mm-hmm, some maybe previously felt dead part of them inside, right? Mm-hmm. And so for a little window of time, they also are able to feel, I don't know, I guess, more of a rainbow of experience in mm-hmm sort of this twisted way. I don't know.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
And again, some of these drugs are not considered addictive, like hallucinogens are not. People don't develop a compulsive use per se, even though they might like them a lot. But these other drugs, and I think cannabis, marijuana is as well, can be addictive too. But again, it's not the drug itself that's addictive. It's like all the elements coming together that brings about a compulsive use.
Right.
Because there's behavioral addictions as well, whether it's gambling or whatever, it's considered the same, but there's no substance there. Mm-hmm. But it's getting all the different kinds of rewards and things that I don't have to get into right now, but same kinds of things.
So given the fact that the culture around marijuana has changed so much, mm-hmm, certainly since I was in high school and mm-hmm college, how are you dealing with that in the addiction world?
It's really tough because some people generally the addicts just think, whatever, it's just weed or it's just a drink. But what can happen to the person who has an addiction or a substance use disorder severe is that desire to change your mood, to get high, can start triggering again to push that high to greater highs, going back to what your original drug of choice was. Mm-hmm. And so that's what it can cause, sort of that, the domino effect, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I know that most kids around here can get access to marijuana much easier than alcohol.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Right? So.
And Ritalin and amphetamines and
right,
all of these.
Right. So what are you seeing most in your treatment? I mean, is it just all over the board? I mean, we're talking about certain things that tend to go through cycles of,
we're seeing a lot of opiate addictions and methamphetamine addictions, and we were talking about dopamine before. So here's an example. So if a person gets a dopamine surge, if you will, with food of, let's say 50 times the normal, and maybe with, intimate relations, 100 times the normal, methamphetamines is like 1,200 times the normal. So these drugs are shortcuts and overwhelming to our reward system in our brain. So they're very, very powerful. So meth, and then unfortunately with opiates now, with heroin, there's also now fentanyl and carfentanyl, mm-hmm, which is just increasing the risk again, and people are overdosing and overdosing and overdosing. But at the same time, there's Narcan now. And so again, people can overdose a number of times and be brought back, if you will.
And what is your experience with, okay, so let's say you OD and then you, receive Narcan, and is that a motivator to stop using?
Or no.
Or people just keep on going?
Just keep on going. They just keep on going, usually. And just look for more and more, and just, it's like a further high.
Wow. So what's that like for you working in addiction and seeing all this?
It's very difficult, and it can be difficult because you want to approach every client with compassion. But at the same time, it's a dangerous business because people can go out and relapse. And relapse is considered a normal part, really, of any change of any kind of behavior you want to do, whether it's eating or driving too fast, whatever it is, we tend to relapse, if you will, and go back to older behaviors because of cravings and relapse. This is a normal part of an addiction process. And people might go out in shorter periods of time. You just hope they make it through and come back.
So what kind of work do you do for yourself to deal with that? Because I think it is a difficult population that you're working with, and such important work. But what do you do with that?
Some of the same things that we talk to clients about. the importance of mindful meditation, for example, in order to become aware of your emotions, be aware of what's happening inside, yet be more objective about them and learn to ground yourself, do healthy activities. In other words, you don't go home and drink scotch, you know, after something like that, because that really, as you know, it doesn't really help.
Right.
So you just try and do healthier things. Like for me, it's a paddle boarding or mm-hmm. scuba diving or whatever it might be, or spending time with family and connection. Because again, if we look at addiction as an attachment disorder, connection is the answer for it. And that's one of the big things we do really in treatment, is allow people to connect even within that environment and with staff. And it's so important within that environment for people to learn to connect again and get that natural feeling of connection.
Or the natural high of connection.
The natural high of connection, right.
Right. Yeah, I think people don't often understand. I have my friends that will say, I don't know how you do that job, you know, and I love what I do. I'm sure you feel the same way.
Well, I do. What I love about it is that I consider therapy to be strength-based. So whenever I'm working with clients, I focus on their strengths. Mm-hmm. And whatever we can do to help remove barriers, but it's always strength-based. So that helps the client and both myself feel sort of empowered and renewed to go after whatever it is. So I find it all very empowering as well.
Yeah, I can.
Particularly when people achieve some sort of resolution to their issues.
Yeah.
Which we see very dramatically in EMDR.
I bet. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Incredible. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I think it's important that as therapists that we take care of ourselves so that we know how to, you know, keep ourselves from those types of risks, because mm-hmm. we're just human too, right? And so it is important that we're doing those activities and being mm-hmm. mindful of how we're engaging with people and, mm-hmm. you know, having a good healthy barrier, I think is a good thing. You have to sort of know.
Again, it's all the same things we're teaching clients.
Right.
How to have healthy boundaries, you know, et cetera.
Right.
Particularly clients coming in. I think a really distressful thing is seeing the number of clients coming in around the age of 20 to 25, 26. And because they've been focusing their lives on a substance, everything else has kind of gone by the wayside again. But that includes life skills, mm-hmm. emotional maturity. We sort of have a saying in the sense that whenever the age at which somebody starts their use is the emotional age at which you're working with them.
Wow.
And I really find that to be true, because mm-hmm. it becomes an emotional immaturity, because
right.
people haven't learned to tolerate uncomfortable feelings, whether it's boredom or sadness or life trauma, mm-hmm. how to work through those and accept them, mm-hmm. you know, and let your body and let yourself heal through natural ways. Even if you continue to be sad, at least you can, you know, you're learning to function with whatever that issue is. But when people are coming in at 24, 25, and they really have a difficult time just simply dealing with any setbacks, you know, you're trying to build resilience, you're trying to build life skills. We help clients with getting their school diplomas if that's what's needed, or jobs, and trying to help them once they leave the treatment center. So it's not just simply, here, you've stopped using for, you know, 60 days, good luck in show business kind of thing.
Right, right.
But try to, you know, continue to help with them moving on.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that giving them those skills is really important. It is true for really, I think, addiction, trauma, that oftentimes whatever age you were, like if your mom died when you were a certain age, or mm-hmm. you had a car accident, or mm-hmm. you know, you really can get stuck at that stage developmentally and not really mm-hmm. emotionally move through it.
Right.
So it does, it sort of stunts you in some way.
And particularly at these sensitive times, you know, where they feel the brain does a lot of activation, a lot of pruning, if you will. That's like your early adolescence,
yeah.
and that's your early childhood.
Yep.
And these are the periods where people are more sensitive to problems going on.
Right.
And so when you introduce traumas or introduce drugs later on, they can have a major, major impact that carry beyond those years.
Yeah, and as you were talking about isolation, I was thinking about social media and how if you start to combine, you know, use with sort of the isolation, lack of connection, what we were just saying, that really is the root. I wonder how this next generation, what role that's all playing together in this curating of an image. I mean, there's so much.
It is so much. And we're seeing a lot of issues just simply with that. I mean, as you see across the board.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw it just even with adults, because I remember when cell phones first came out, and all the parents were saying, don't you dare use that phone in the car. And how long did it take before all the adults were driving around texting on the freeway?
Completely.
So it's just simply a natural kind of, you know, these phones are designed to get your attention and to reward your attention.
To be addictive.
Yes, be very addictive.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about, actually, if you're just tuning in before I go on, you're listening to Bert Shepley and myself, Dr. Kim Sage on the Dr. Kim Sage Show. And we're talking about addiction and trauma and the relationship. Bert is a licensed marriage and family therapist. So let's talk about the transmission of trauma over generations. Mm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So it's been demonstrated that trauma can actually genetically transmit through generations, as sort of demonstrated by children of trauma victims, children of Holocaust survivors, and children can be shown to be more vulnerable to depression and anxiety disorders when their parents themselves have gone through trauma themselves. So there are some genetics involved with this, both male and female as well. It's not just on the female, but the male as well.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting. We were discussing this earlier today. You know, I'll sometimes have people in my practice who will think that just because their kids didn't see something, they don't know it existed, right? Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this pre-verbal stage. And so if you think about that sort of carrying on in generations, it's nothing like super crazy, but there's enough there that's being carried, and it becomes very problematic.
Yeah, it does. But here's the good news to all of this is that we're resilient and we can learn resilience. And we're designed to function, if you will.
Right.
And so there's plasticity in the brain, which both allows us to adapt negatively, but also positively.
Right.
Because the use is really just simply adaptive, too.
Right.
Our brain is just learning to adapt to that. So addiction is also considered a learning disorder, attachment disorder, developmental disorder is generally started when people are younger and goes away on its own when people are older. Actually, it's a little different subject, but it's been shown that a number of people who have addiction issues, it will go away on its own. People will just kind of grow out of it as well. It's very, very interesting. That was demonstrated first with a study of Vietnam War veterans coming back, and X percentage were coming back with addictions and heroin. Mm-hmm. And a large percentage of them just, it went away on its own because they were using it in a certain context. Right. And even though they showed use despite negative consequences, et cetera, once they came back out of that with their families or with life here, it just sort of, there wasn't room for it anymore.
Interesting.
So it is very interesting. And it's been shown also with rat studies, because that's where a lot of these studies are done.
Right.
There's a very famous one called the Rat Park study, where they compared rats living in a very sterile environment and how they choose to use, you know, cocaine-laced water versus rats who are living in an environment with lots of giant wheels and playthings, lots of other rats and all these great things.
Right.
And they just choose not to. They're given a choice between water and morphine-laced or cocaine-laced drug. They'll choose just a regular water. There's no need to enhance what is already there.
Wow.
Fascinating.
That is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's that called again?
The Rat Park Study.
The Rat Park Study.
Yeah, you can look it up.
Yeah. When was that done? Do you know? Is it like a while ago?
Yeah, a little while ago, okay. 90s probably, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is really important we talk about too is the resilience and sort of we talk about in EMDR, the adaptive memory networks. Like we're really helping people connect to the parts of themselves that are competent and confident and capable and can cope.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that we often lose sight of that in therapy sometimes, that we really want to also focus on what you do really well.
And clients as well, you know, they may sort of forget the fact that they grew up with a lot of abuse or a lot of issues, and they're survivors of that.
Yeah.
Rather than victims of that, they've actually survived it.
Absolutely.
And they're still here.
Right.
You know, and, right. and still willing to try to deal with it. And this can happen at any age. So.
Yeah, it's never too late.
Never too late.
So how do you help people begin to connect to those strengths? Let's say you're, you know, whether it's your treatment center or an individual therapy, what are you doing to help people foster that sense within themselves?
I try to find things that they feel passionate about, feel good about, have shown competence at. Even if it's just minor moments of feeling that, then I would try to enhance that through hypnosis or EMDR, just to kind of, again, connect to that more adaptive part of themselves to remember what that feeling was to be successful, even if it's a short one. Like, for example, a client who went through the war, through the Iraq War, he landed on an image of them putting the metal in when he finished a certain kind of training, and that feeling of the metal going in with the, you know, the lieutenant or whoever giving it to him and all that. And that became like this really strong image that he could revert back to. And then it began, you know, generalizing out and more like, yeah, I did accomplish something. You know, I can remember that good feeling and focus on that as well.
I love that. I love that about EMDR in general. But that sort of connecting to where you are, your most, you know, loved, powerful self and strong self. Can you talk a bit about hypnosis and the role of trauma and addiction?
Yeah, again, hypnosis sort of is the roots of EMDR. It has a lot to do with relaxing your conscious mind and allowing your unconscious to receive positive suggestions. So it's very, once again, image-based, positive-based, if you will. And so it allows people to approach their traumas or approach issues in a safe way, in a way that's metaphorical and with images and allegorical maybe, and using that to support themselves through the image. But as well, you know, these things also touch on dissociative parts of people, which is what is usually also at the core of traumas. It's sort of been theorized that one of the things that you can see with people who experience trauma and they get the PTSD is because at that moment of that shock, they've dissociated. And when they dissociate, then they can't put the whole memory together in sort of a narrative form. And so that's part of the issue as well. So it's kind of using those same tools, if you will.
Right. Yeah, I think that we know that people often have to dissociate to deal with what's going on, especially ongoing chronic trauma, like, you know, childhood sexual abuse, things like that. Like, I have to go somewhere else. I have to be somewhere else in order to endure this.
Right.
A lot of survivors talk about that. You know, I think that is a survival mechanism, and then it can also be an impediment in terms of doing like EMDR, for example. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, if somebody is very easily falling into a dissociative state, then they lose a grounding and connection with what's happening in the moment, and they become very, very dysregulated and just leave the room, if you will, or, you know, in more extreme examples, can be floating above or somewhere else. So they're just leaving. Again, that's a form of defense to protect yourself from those awful memories and awful feelings. And so you have to be aware that that's happening. And at the more extreme examples, you can run into dissociative identity disorder, where those parts of you have become sort of crystallized in a protective way.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is something that if you want to do EMDR, you need to be, you know, aware of. If you tend to be, you know, have a strong tendency to dissociate, we need to be aware of that and see if you're a good candidate. One thing I want to talk about is not everyone is a candidate for EMDR.
Right.
Can you talk about that in terms of especially how it ties into our topic tonight with trauma and addiction?
Let's see, probably a few ways. One, the dissociation, again, because they can't stay with you. Excuse me, part of the work of EMDR is keeping the person sort of one foot in the trauma and one foot out in the room itself with you.
Right.
So that allows the person to manage what's happening without getting overwhelmed. If the person tends to dissociate, then you have to do a lot more grounding kinds of exercises and work before you start putting them into their memories where they can really sort of leave. But it can also be difficult, again, if people are shut off from their feelings, shut off from their emotions. It's very difficult to reach it. It's like, I don't know what I feel. I don't really know. So you might have to do some psychoeducation about what emotions are, you know, what feelings are, what's happening in the body, sort of re-explain everything that's going on so they have an idea of what's happening with them and why they're feeling so disconnected.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. It's helping people understand what's going on, how to connect to what they're feeling and what's, you know, what the experience is. Are there any typical, would you say, and this is going to sound maybe weird, but, you know, what types of trauma tend to lend themselves to addiction issues? Is there a theme in some regard or no?
My guess, I would say most likely it's complex trauma, because again, if we look at addiction as also partly developmental problem, that it happens more to people when they're younger, they get into addiction, than when they're older, when their thinking brain's more online. But when they're younger, they're more ruled by emotions and their thinking brain isn't really online to help them with this decision making.
Okay, that makes sense. But so complex trauma is really...
So complex trauma in which the person's gone through a lot of different situations that, again, have maybe have interfered with their attachment, interfered with their ability to do anything, just constant, whether it goes from constant abuse to just bullying, being bullied. There's so many of these things that happen to people, and maybe they're being bullied because they have autism, they're on the spectrum somewhere, or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. These can be very, very overwhelming experiences on a consistent basis, and that's complex trauma, where it's repeated over a period of time. And I would say those probably lend themselves more.
That makes sense.
Because a single event trauma can sometimes be more readily wrapped your head around, and it accepts like, okay, everything's kind of going okay, and then this huge event, which took me by surprise, whatever it might be.
Right.
I can sort of get that. I don't necessarily need to go self-medicate from that unless you're younger and you just can't
right.
deal with it.
Right.
You know, again, that's why it's kind of considered also a developmental mm-hmm. sort of issue.
And I think that's why it can be more impactful to have an accumulation of traumas mm-hmm. or these complex traumas. That one event, if your life is somewhat manageable, mm-hmm. you sort of can wrap your mind around it. You can mm-hmm. even do EMDR for this event. You know, you have a beginning and an end and a mm-hmm. whole thing. But when you start connecting one trauma, what they tend to do, like a spider web, I think, is just connect to other traumas.
Right.
And they all become so entangled.
It can be very, very complicated.
Yes. I found with clients that they have a lot of complex trauma, well, we're doing the work, and they're just going everywhere. It's
right.
really hard to keep them on one specific event.
Yeah.
Right? Understandably right. so. They've had so many.
Yeah. That's why I think it has to be kind of modified for those situations.
Right. Right.
But it's still a very effective way to allow the person to heal from the traumas. There's just a lot more
right.
issues to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've done the most work with clients who have complex trauma with mm-hmm. some of the childhood stuff, not mm-hmm. even necessarily like I was a victim of a shooting or whatever. It's
right.
more like this, my mom was an alcoholic, or, you know, I had this happen and that happen. And so, mm-hmm. yeah. So if you're interested in EMDR, YouTube has great videos. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The EMDRIA website mm-hmm. Has great information. Mm-hmm. You can Google it, people, but I highly encourage you if you're listening and you're wondering, I may want to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
If you are suffering from some sort of substance use issue mm-hmm. and or trauma, but let's talk about substance use, or you love someone who is, what are the paths that you would recommend at this point?
I would recommend, if you can, talking to a treatment center and getting some options from them, but actually do your homework on the treatment centers. There's lots of different kinds. Some are, I don't know, more ethical than others, you might say. So look for certain accreditations. You would want to talk to other family members, see if you can talk to that person to see if there's an issue. You know, again, going from pre-contemplation to contemplation. Try to approach it with as much love as you can, and just understanding that the person is really not, it's wrong to say not in control, but they really are taken over and hijacked by this addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very confusing because you see somebody drinking or using a drug and you just want to say, don't pick up, or hey, just don't do it.
Right.
But I kind of liken it to really strong magnets that, if you feel the magnets coming together close, 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 even when you get to the very bottom, close to the other magnet, you have a choice.
Right.
But it's not much of a choice.
But it's pulling you
really
hard.
It's really about that.
Yeah. I like that analogy.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for joining me, Bert Shevely.
Oh, we're over already.
Okay. Yes, we'll have to come back. We had some technical difficulties tonight, so we will definitely, if you're willing to come back, I think you've got some great information to share, and your passion comes through, so mm-hmm. thank you for that. Tell us, our guests, really quickly where they can reach you.
You can reach me at my website, BertShepleyMFT.com, or 714-642-3991.
One more time?
714-642-3991.
Wonderful.
Operator standing by.
Exactly. Thank you. We need a technical person standing by.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining me. And like I said, I hope you will come back.
Yes.
You've listened to the Dr. Kim Sage Show. The show airs live on Monday evenings at 8 p.m., and I just try to explore therapy topics and psychology topics, but we're really focusing more now on chronic stress and trauma mm-hmm. and really helping people understand this sort of impact in our lives. And so it just spreads out to everything. So mm-hmm. I think addiction is a hugely important one. So thank you. And you can also hear the show live on your computer, streaming it, or you can listen to the podcast usually the next day it's posted. And just thanks for tuning in. Have a beautiful evening, and I will see you guys next week.